You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm here this week with Donald E. Westlake, author of, most recently, Drowned Hopes, his newest Dortmunder novel. I'll jump in right away. These are fairly unusual books in that these are about how things go wrong.
Oh, absolutely.
These mystery stories are the stories of clods and bunglers.
Oh, no. They are. I think of them as professional workmen.
Uh-huh.
And that luck is against them and that things go wrong. Well, you know, in all of our lives, things go wrong, little glitches and little errors. But the odds somehow are always more against them than most of us. They take more heat than we do from the gods of luck.
What does Dortmunder mean?
What is the word itself?
Yeah, is this I thought dorky world or
well, I guess there's parts of that. No, what had happened was first of all, I never knew I was going to do more than one book about this guy. If I'd known he was going to be a series hero, I would have named him Lance or something, but he was only going to be in for one book. And so I was looking for a name for him, and I wanted something that would suggest an active kind of heroic kind of guy where something's gone wrong. And I was looking around, and remember there's a beer, D-A-B, Dortmunder Aktien Beer, A-C-T-I-E-N. I said, oh, action. Spelled wrong. That seems right.
Uh-huh.
So I named Dortmunder after the beer.
And one of the characteristics of this novel is, of course, that no one can give correct road directions. And, in fact, the dark hero of the book always calls Dortmunder by an extremely indirect name. He's been in jail with Dortmunder and knows that his middle name, which he hates, is Archibald, and right, thinking that Al is a nickname for Archibald,
right,
he calls him Al. His name is, in fact,
John.
John, and he lives with his wife, May, and they are in a book that includes a character named Myrtle Street, who lives on Myrtle Street.
Yes, poor girl.
This is a world I like very much. I live in it. You know? Is this kind of, you know, you do more darker crime writing as well, but these sort of moribund, wrong-headed capers, are these like a birthday present you give yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I sort of have to diet in a way. I don't know what's the word I'm looking for, but I have to pace myself. And I've promised myself and my wife and my publisher and my agent and and the guy in the subway and everybody that I will do no more than one Dortmunder book every three books, because I could just hang out with those people forever. And I'm afraid that way self-indulgence lies. You know, I would just sort of have if I am the only one having a good time, I'm doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I could with them. I could just fall into it.
I screamed with screamed with pleasure when I heard you've got great side characters. There are conversations that are going on that are always being interrupted by the arrival of these heroes or anti-heroes. And one of them takes place in a bar where people are discussing whether or not yuppies are aliens. And I wondered if you would, because I don't want to step on your punchline, tell us what it is that the yuppies are supposedly here for.
Well, they have two theories working in the bar. And one is that the yuppies are aliens who are here to get our technological equipment, particularly stereo equipment. and the other theory is that the new large apartment houses with the tiny rooms are yuppie traps, and that the yuppies aren't the aliens. The yuppies are being harvested by the aliens, and that once all those big buildings are full, it'll turn out they're spaceships, and the buildings will all fly away.
Well, I had forgotten those. My favorite is one Bar Denison's theory that they've come looking for tofu.
Well, that is part of it, too, yes. And the sneakers, they explain to each other that you take a look at those sneakers they wear. They obviously don't fit on human feet.
The other person sitting next to him on the next stool said, no, they didn't come looking for tofu. They brought it with them. I'm talking to Donald Westlake, author most recently of Drowned Hopes and the screenwriter of The Stepfather as well. Now, that's a case, that movie, of a really harrowing and dark hero stepping up into an American scene, very much like the American scene is in the Dortmunder books. Otherwise, these are, you know, rosy people who've got a lot of love for casserole.
Yes.
What do you suppose it is, a somewhat philosophical question, that turns, you know, from comedy to pathology? Where is there a demarcation point?
I don't think so. No, I think that for me, it's storytelling. And I like to think of storytelling as being an interactive sport. I like to get a reaction, so that I would like to have you laugh, or I would like to have you go ooh, or cry, or do something. I don't want you just sitting there. I want some sort of reaction, and getting up to a really frightening point. And I don't mean doing something like a slasher movie, because The Stepfather wasn't a slasher movie. That was the problem it had. It sort of fell between stools there. But getting that feeling of tension, something's going to happen, I don't know what it is really quite similar to building towards the punchline of a joke. There's going to be a release of tension in laugh or scream or whatever. And that's, I like that. I like, I love words to begin with, and I love them to burrow down into your brain and do something.
Mm-hmm. Given the way these characters talk, I particularly like that your baddest of the bad barely moves his mouth when he speaks, nor does he do so when he eats.
That's right.
What led to him?
Well, the character himself comes out of, in fact, another screenwriting job. I have to explain here that I've done not very much screenplay writing, but I've done some over the years. And around the time that I was starting to work on this book, I'd started to work on the book, and then there was talk about me writing a screenplay. And then the writer's strike came along. So, okay, fine, I'm not going to do the screenplay. I'm going to go back and work on my book. And the screenplay was based on a novel by Jim Thompson, who is a cult figure now and was a pulp writer of the 50s and 60s. So it was I had read a lot of books of his over the years, but it had been a while. And this is the first time that I've ever done an adaptation of somebody else's book.
Which book were you working on?
It's called The Grifters, with a G.
Oh, sure, yeah. Yes. It's being made now.
It's done. The picture will probably be out in September, I think. The strike ended, and I finally got to do the thing.
That was Frears, right?
Stephen Frears directed it,
right.
And it's Angelica Houston and John Cusack are starring. Anyway, I feel that the adapter of a novel to a screenplay, that at the end of the day, the movie should not be a Westlake movie, but it should be a Thompson movie, that it should look like him. So I reread a bunch of his early, I don't know, they're all early now, since he's been dead for 14 years. But I reread a bunch of his books, and I read some things about him. And then I stopped working on all that because of the strike and went back to work on this thing. And a character named Tom Jimson came out of it, and he is my Jim Thompson character.
Uh-huh, Tom Jimson, Jim Thompson. Oh, it's only in a Westlake novel. I see that for sure. It is interesting that Thompson, I can think of a scene like this in the work of no other writer, that Thompson has a criminal go home to his mother, embrace her, and lift her up, and she's so afraid of him that the mother urinates. This is the imagination of no one else.
Yes, this. Yeah, Jim Thompson was a dark poet in many ways and a grim guy. I know a couple of people who knew him, and my New York agent was his editor at Dell and at Gold Medal a little bit. And he was kind of a gloomy guy, and it came out. You know, he wasn't the comedian playing Hamlet. He was Hamlet playing
mm-hmm,
Hamlet.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get that. I wanted to be true to him in writing the screenplay. So he came into my consciousness and into what I was doing a bit. So I've got a comic novel of mine with a truly uncomic character of his wandering through it.
Right. You know, it's very funny because when you're reading Drowned Hopes, until Jimson appears in a scene, you may not know he's there. He's so quiet that sometimes yes. I'll be in a car as I'm reading, and I'm reading about the people in the car, and I think to myself, gee, I wonder if Jimson is there. And then he says something
right.
suddenly with his unmoving lips, and I said, ah, Jimson is there, but how quiet he,
yes.
how quiet he can be. This is the longest Dortmunder novel. And they say the most complicated. And it is like, many fallen souffles in a row.
That's right. Yes, well, if at first you don't succeed, they try again.
I wonder, in fact, if you know the story. In the course of Drowned Hopes, the new mystery comedy novel by Donald E. Westlake out from Mysterious Press, they tell the story of the man who wanted to make the soft drink. Yes, you know this story, perhaps, called One Up.
One Up and then Two Up, and he kept revising, and he got all the way up to Six Up and then quit.
And then quit, and, you know. And that is how this novel works.
That's right. Yes, exactly how this works. Yes.
Yeah. I kind of clapped my hands, you know, in a wan way and said, okay, a shaggy dog story for all times. And of course, those scuba diving instructors always win.
I suppose.
Do you sit around with notebooks gathering bits of effluvium for characters, malapropisms, puns, and jokes? Are you a snooper?
No. I think of my brain as compost, and it all goes in and mulches for a while, and then what comes out. I've never been organized enough to write it down. Also, for me, once I've written it down, it's done. I could never outline, because if I wrote an outline of the book, I'd never be able to write the book.
How do you suppose other people manage that?
I don't know. I think I know a number of writers, and no two of us think about it the same way. No two of us work the same way in any way at all. It's sort of bewildering to talk to a guy and he says, "Oh yes, well I do this." And oh, that would kill me. I would never be able to do it your way, and he'd never be able to do it my way. So I don't know.
But does it strike you? It's often struck me that certain kinds of intricate effects cannot be achieved without index cards. That if someone were to sit and try really to do Feydeau with nothing up their sleeves, either they'd have to rewrite again and again and again and again and again, or they'd just have to give up that kind of...
Well, yes. Well, that's when what you're really writing is a Rube Goldberg invention then. So, yes, you would have to do. But I don't. And it's funny you talk about index cards. When I've worked on a screenplay, I do use index cards because there it is much more sort of a set of instructions. It's a manual, you know, for the way you construct this bicycle is you follow this set of instructions. But with a book, you know, the science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon, his second law was a justification for narrative push as a writing method. And he said, if the writer doesn't know what's going to happen next, the reader can't possibly know.
Are there any other such rules?
That's the only one I know. That's the only one I know.
That's so much nicer than the one that I think it was Feydeau who does say, in the first act I send them up the tree after the monkeys, in the second act I have them throw coconuts down, and in the third act I throw coconuts back at them. It's much nicer not to know know anything at all.
I've learned over the years to trust myself in that, because particularly in the early years, there are segments of novels that wound up, they were simply going deeper and deeper into the woods and forget it. But it's gotten better, and I've learned to trust my own instincts. So that, for instance, in this book, in Drowned Hopes, there's a wedding. Now, when I put the wedding in, I had no idea what it was there for. It amused me to take this group of people and put them in a wedding. And that the characters in the wedding, that the wedding itself would have some meaning later on, maybe it would. Maybe it would turn out to be a mistake, and if it turned out to be a mistake, then I would take it out. But I had the feeling that it would find its own purpose. And it did. And I think that it usually works that way. Sometimes I have to say, well, okay, that didn't work. But usually it works.
You're a computer genius in this book. Is this his first appearance?
Yes, yes. He's brand new.
He's great. What is his
name? I love Wally. Wally Knurr. K-N-U-R-R, Knurr.
He's a recluse, I guess, a recluse blob who lives among his computers, right, and who likes to play interactive games in which he rescues the princess and does other useful tasks.
Yes, exactly.
And so when the crooks come to him and ask him to input some real-life data, it's all screwed up with the elements of fairy tales and science fiction in which he's been functioning. And he's kind of a wonderful Prince Charming in this. He has a courtship with a librarian. And,
right, right.
I felt very tenderly toward him. did he just swim into vision?
But I think where he came from, partly, is that interactive fiction, I don't think, has ever really taken off. It came around for a while, and I like storytelling. Show me a new way to tell a story, and you've got my attention. So I was saying, I don't have a computer, and I don't know anything about this, but this is interesting, this interactive fiction. And there's a friend of mine, is a science fiction writer, Tom Dish, and he did a brilliant piece, a thing called Amnesia. Which begins, the person operating the thing, you wake up in a hotel room because the phone is ringing and it's the manager saying you have 15 minutes to vacate the room. You are naked and you have amnesia. and it goes on from there. So I think the point where I fell in love with the whole idea was he told me that at one point in his storyline, he had his character in a large building which included a chapel, and he had the character run through the chapel. So when you get to that point with this kind of storytelling, you have to give a variety of possible routes for people. And so he said it occurred to him that some people would want the character to say a prayer when he's in the chapel, because he's being chased by people who want to kill him. And it seems like a good time and place to get in touch with God. So he wrote a prayer, an amnesiac's prayer, and it's in his interactive fiction. His assumption is that 1 person in 100 will call it up, but it's there. And something about that led me to what is sweet and beautiful about interactive fiction, and that led to Wally Knurr. I don't know how, but it did.
I wanted to ask you about the lower middle class, and I wanted to begin by talking about a different kind of writing.
Okay.
In A Simple Heart, Flaubert builds the whole sitting room for his characters so that as we're looking at the mantelpiece famously, we know about the people before they ever come into the room. Mm-hmm. In fact, since this is going to be the story of Félicité, the servant, we know about her relationship to them by the way she cleans their objects. Now, when I was reading Drowned Hopes, I was delighted by a paragraph taken to explain where dinner for six would fit in a small apartment. Because I grew up that way, where you take the kitchen table from the kitchen and you put it in the living room. You take the living room chair and you put it in the kitchen.
That's
you
right.
take the side table, the footstool, and you put them in the bedroom. And then you take the kitchen chair. And I thought, my goodness, you know these houses so well. And the anticipation of the tuna casserole on everyone's part.
And sooner or later, somebody has to sit on a phone book because it's too low.
And it's great because in this case, two people have to sit on phone books, so it's lucky that we have yellow pages and white pages.
That's right.
I felt, unlike Jim Thompson, you're not precisely a poet, but you are a vaudevillian of this lower middle class dexterity.
Uh-huh.
Is this family hijinks? Is this, you know, there is affection there. It's not the kind of thing that people talk about the minimalist as not liking their characters. Clearly you love these guys.
Oh, yeah.
These are
a
crew you know. Whence the consanguinity?
Well, I didn't grow up in an outer borough, you know, which they did, unless you count Albany, New York. It's an extremely outer borough.
Uh-huh.
But I grew up pretty much in that milieu. I grew up in the kind of Irish Catholic family that hid its poverty, which is a full-time job. It's really exhausting. And so there were people I knew who had relaxed into it. And I think I grew up rather loving their households more than my own, because they were easy with who they were.
I'm talking to Donald E. Westlake, the author of the very funny Drowned Hopes, the most recent Dortmunder novel, recently published by the Mysterious Press. Now, there is, early on in the book, someone's statement, one of these lowbrow crooks, probably lowbrow is the wrong word, that the people on crack who are getting into jail and who are stealing in order to get crack are stupid. You know, these are really stupid criminals. Yours are a couple of steps above stupid. They've got enough skills to be able to, you know, distinguish themselves from the lower vertebrates.
They think of themselves as workmen. They think of themselves as skilled labor, and they have contempt for it. Yeah, I think, in fact, it's Jimson who says, you, Al, you know as well as I do, that the reasons to rob a bank are either to get your poor niece the operation that will save her life or to go party in Miami. But these guys have no motivations. All they want to do is feed their nose.
These class distinctions amongst the ex-cons are typical of the kind of discussions that go on in your work, the way in which people judge one another. Now, I was curious about May because she seems to be the kindliest of all the women. So put upon, but so very willing, you know, to have another dinner, to persuade her husband to have yet one more go at this hopeless rescuing of a treasure from under the murk of a reservoir. Who is she?
Well, she's the earth mother that John Dortmunder desperately needed,
uh-huh.
And I guess what we all do. But I hope that she isn't, you know, namby-pamby or a Hallmark greeting card, but she's part of the world. It's not that she's accepting his world. She's part of his world. But within the world that she's part of, she's just a very supportive person.
Oh, she's not namby-pamby because her complacency is so funny. I mean, you know, she really, you know, puts up with quite a lot, and she puts up with it very, you know, well. She's a kind of ballerina. Of
That's nice.
Well, what happens next to Dortmunder?
Oh, I don't know. I'm in the time now where I'm tapering off.
The Dortmunder diet.
That's right.
I've been talking to Donald E. Westlake, author of Drowned Hopes, most recently published by Mysterious Press, most recent of his books to be published by Mysterious Press. It's been a great pleasure to have you with us, and we look forward to the Grifters and whatever else comes, you know, next, Dortmunder or otherwise.
Thank you.
My name is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. Won't you join me again next week on Bookworm?
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.